California.
Yeah, well, it's, I don't know what it is, but it shows that we are all one. So good morning, Bruce. Good morning, everybody. You've got Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson here at the House of the Risen Sun, and we are here to discuss A Course in Miracles. And here it is, the end of the year. We just are finishing our last lessons of the year, getting ready to start the new year, in which it appears that there's going to be some pretty large changes going on in our world, in our culture, in our society. And I think it's kind of scary. I know a lot of folks have been posting on Facebook, a lot of very frightened, fearful thoughts about what's going to happen with the new government in America. And, you know, I know that in Europe, a lot of people in the UK are having difficulty with Brexit and all the troubles that we appear to be having with Russia. And, you know, it's just like, you know, we're starting out a new year with lots and lots of challenges. And also starting out a new year as Course in Miracles students and teachers. And how do we do that? How do we as students of Course in Miracles reflect our faith and our belief and our trust in God while at the same time seeing lots of fear going on in the world? So that's a thought, and I am sure that you have a link for us to look at on the FACIM side as well.
I do.
Yeah.
I guess it didn't show up the first time, but I just
here it is. I just
yep.
got it.
Yeah. As you were talking, Lynn, I was reminded of sort of like in the chewing gum and walking phenomena. I think it's so tempting to think, well, gee, I can't actually be mindful and you know, politically active or socially responsible or, you know, watch the news or, you know, without being upset or what, but all that stuff is basically our classroom, and it's an opportunity for us to use what's in our unconscious mind to get home. And without that, we wouldn't be able to do that. I think that's one of the areas that, is ripe for level of confusion. And I think the classic example that Kim Wapnick points out is the bliss ninny approach, where it's a triple denial, because we deny the contents of our mind, which is in terms of the ego mind anyway, is the unconscious guilt and the whole thought system of sin, guilt, and fear, and then we deny the world by, you know, we deny the world on a couple levels. You know, we basically deny that the things that are not to our liking as egos, and then we further deny by making a world that isn't there. You know, that's the bliss ninny approach. But most of us, most of the time, probably are just in the two-level denial approach, in that we don't try to sugarcoat what the world calls reality, but it's interesting though, because on this FAQ I think ties into it pretty nicely. It's really, you know, we really do have to you know, look at what's going on in our seemingly individual and certainly our collective world as a way of getting at the contents of our unconscious mind. And without that classroom, we'd never get home. So, you know, it's doable. It's probably possible. And, you know, you know, there are examples of ascetics who go off and live in caves that become enlightened and sort of thing. But that's kind of not the norm. That's not the recommended path to remembering who we are, which is really not a who, it's a what.
So exactly.
Do you want to start reading the FAQ, or do you have further?
I just wanted to say something about that too, is that I've noticed that there seem to be a couple of different kinds of persons who are claiming to be awakened or enlightened. And I'm sure there's probably more than a couple, but what I notice is that there are people who claim awakening or enlightenment, and they are what I think a lot of us, and maybe Ken, would probably call bliss ninnies, as in they are just completely ignoring the world in their lives, and it's almost like there's something went wrong in their brain, like there was some kind of a break in their brain that put them in a place where they are feeling ecstatic and happy, but they're also, you know, like completely ignoring the world around them. And I'm not saying that that doesn't mean that they're not really enlightened, because that may be what it is. But I also think that, you know, I see people who claim to be enlightened or awakened who are very concerned about the world and very concerned about, you know, we need to, you know, eradicate poverty and hunger, and we need to stop destroying the environment, and we need to, you know, fix up the, you know, whatever. You know, they have this very active thought about the world and how we need to do things in the world to make it different. And I don't think that's it either. I'm trying to zone in on what this awakening or enlightenment is. And for me, I have this example of Jesus in A Course in Miracles. And, you know, what he is saying is, don't deny what you see. Don't deny what the ego is telling you. Look at it and recognize that it's not true, and let it go, which is a lot different than just saying it doesn't exist. Because with the actual examination and practice of forgiveness, we see the truth of what it is, and we can let it go. And I think that that's what Jesus did. Jesus changed the world. Jesus changed the thinking of the world. What he started, you know, supposedly 2,000 years ago, which, you know, obviously is a part of the illusion of time, but what he started had rippled out to where, you know, it's a big causative effect in the world today. And so, you know, he had a different look on things. And he, you know, he says, I didn't suffer. I wasn't afraid. I was happy. I was joyful. I was loving. You know, he was interaction and acting.
Where does it say that?
Well, he says that in the Course. Yeah. Basically, he says, you know, all those things that you heard about me suffering and, you know, the crucifixion being all that, that really wasn't my state of mind at the time at all.
Right.
So, you know, and so, you know, I'm seeing that and seeing, you know, he's given us an example of what a really truly enlightened person is. And he did heal the sick. He did walk among people. He did, you know, teach. He, you know, I'm just saying that I'm looking to this figure of Jesus that I read about in A Course in Miracles as my example of what an enlightened person is. And so when I look around the world and I see people who claim to be enlightened, I don't see that in their behavior or thinking. So, you know, and I'm not trying to get into, you know, who is or who isn't. I'm just saying, you know, if it's something we're all hoping for and working toward and believing that is our natural right, maybe it would be good to have an idea of what that really means, before we go trying to claim it, because maybe when we know what it means, we'll recognize the truth about it, and we won't be we won't be claiming things. There's no, like Ken, he didn't claim anything, but it's very clear to me that he was as enlightened as he could be. So, you know, I don't know. Anyway, let's go.
I just want to comment on that, because I think you've hit on something really important there. Is if there's an identity that's separate from other identities making a claim, that's usually a clue right there that there's something not complete, or shall we say, immature in that that claim or that statement, because the whole premise of A A Course in Miracles is that it's a pure non-dual teaching. And it's teaching that that's what we are, not necessarily who we are, but what we are, because our identity is, I'm going to hearken to Richard Bach, you know, is as perfect as an unwritten number everywhere, once across space and time, or beyond space and time. paraphrase, I'm sure. But that's, I think that's the premise that we sometimes forget, is that, that awareness, originates from a place where there is an impossibility for suffering of any kind, and for pain or grief or any kind of upset, and that isn't our everyday normal reality, because that's the antithesis of our everyday normal reality if we're honest with ourselves.
Exactly.
And that, I think, leads to an aloof attitude that's devoid of compassion and devoid of the awareness that is able to look dispassionately but compassionately at the world, recognizing that our identity ultimately is and must be not dissociated in any kind of a dysfunctional way, but dissociated in the sense that we have to gradually shift our identity to one of total inclusion, where the idea of being separate from any particular part, or different from any particular part of the oneness that we all share, is unthinkable. And I think that's what's so challenging. And then Ken Wapnick points this out in his curriculum beautifully, and of course Jesus does too, that it really is one of the most challenging parts, if not the most challenging part, of A Course in Miracles as a curriculum, because it's asking us to say, to remember that if I exclude anyone or anything, be it a prominent political figure or as someone of a different geographic, gender, economic, whatever. Any
spiritual belief,
claim of enlightenment, not claim of enlightenment. Anything that seems to be different from anything or anyone else, we're basically saying that I'm still invested in duality. But the only way we can get completely free of that is not by denying it in the world, but by getting to the source of it in our mind and healing the source of the separation. I think this FAQ addresses it very nicely. So do you want to read the first part?
Sure.
First part? Okay.
All right. So, and let me post the link in the room so that other folks can go and take a look at it as well. Uh-huh. We are on 1251, facimoutreach.org, question number 1251. All right, so I am having difficulty understanding how my interactions with other people who are going through the same process of learning that their thoughts are creating reality are able to coexist and not interfere with one another. Okay. I'm having difficulty understanding how my interactions with other people who are going through the same process of learning that their thoughts are creating reality are able to coexist and not interfere with one another. If I believe and understand that reality is a manifestation of thought, does this not have an effect on other people? What if I have thoughts about another person? How can my reality possibly make our two realities come together? If the situation has been decided by all involved beforehand, then I feel as though I am in a grand illusion that is no longer a good space to be in. It would be nice to get some validation that I'm not a puppet on someone's string. I am giving 100% to learning how to relearn that the world, in this email for that matter, is only a thought and nothing more. I got the concept that we are all the same energy, but I don't understand it when it relates to individuality. So this, oh my gosh, this is the big question, isn't it?
Oh yeah. It really goes right to the heart of the emphasis on relationships that A Course in Miracles has, isn't it? doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. If there's nobody else out there, then, you know, what am I relating to?
Right.
And if I'm relating to somebody, that must mean that they're there. Uh-huh. And, I mean, it's just the proof. And, wow, you know, this is, in fact, I was listening or reading Nisargadatta the other night, and he was saying this very basic, very same thing. You know, as long as you believe that there's two, you'll never know that there's one. And, you know, and then this is what this person is saying. How do, and I hear this all the time too, you know, how do I relate to others? And, you know, if there are no others, then what am I doing here? And, you know, to come to the place where you're actually recognizing that you're really just relating to your own self.
Mm-hmm.
And really there are no others, but that, you know, that's coming up. But I like the question, you know, did somebody already decide this beforehand? Am I a puppet on somebody's string? You know, do I have no choice whatsoever? What is going on here? Is the script is written? Does that mean that I can't decide to be a blonde this week and a brunette next week? You know, is that, what does that really mean? So this is an excellent question.
And I think we're all the blonde leading the blonde, you know, when we
I
can resist it. When it comes to trying to solve the problems from the level that we made them up, as Einstein would say.
Exactly. So this is a really good question. And I think I have heard so many people ask the same question over and over. In fact, I've asked this question myself over and over until I just came to the realization, well, there's not two, there's only one. So it doesn't matter, you know, if I see it, it's because I'm projecting it. And, you know, people will say, well, that's not true, because if I'm sitting here and you stand up, does that mean that I stood up too? No, but it means that you wouldn't be there to stand up if I wasn't seeing you from...
I never thought about that way, Lynn. That's astonishing. Sitting, standing duality. That's good. And I think it's so important to have a sense of humor too, because it really is laughable. I mean, in truth, the things that we make such big deals out of. I came across that over the last few days, and my wife Nancy and I have been settling into our place there, and there was, inevitably there are, you know, issues that arise about, well, what should we do with this, and what goes where, and how do we want to handle this, and, you know, what is our schedule going to be like, and you know, the whole gamut of stuff that comes up, you know, and I don't think that's going to be unfamiliar to anyone that you know, shares a household or a life in any measure with anyone else, because there's always, the world is based on differences, and that's where, you know, we are trained by ourselves to relate to these alleged others as different. And once there's differences and sameness goes out the window, then the adversarial mindset, which is the ego's, you know, core the core misbelief.
Us or them.
We versus they, us and them. Yeah, exactly. You know, like Pogo said, we have met the enemy and they is us, you know.
And they is us. Yeah, and that taking that personal responsibility, you know, I know we're going to get into this answer, but, you know, just for an example for me, the taking of personal responsibility for the world that I appear to be experiencing has really become very personal. I mean, very personal to me, because I recognize that, like, I have, you know, lots of relationships with my family and people around me. And, you know, whatever they are doing or saying to me or whatever I seem to be seeing in them, I recognize it's all in my own mind. I'm the one who is deciding how to interpret what they say, how to think about what I see. And, you know, if I have a relationship with someone who is, you know, always pushing my button, you know, I really have to look at that and recognize, oh, it's my button. And I'm, they have nothing to do with it. All they're doing is being what they are. I'm the one who's deciding, oh, I don't like that, and getting upset. Or, oh, I love that, and being happy. But it's all my own decision, everything. And that is really, it's terrible at first, because then you recognize nobody else is responsible for the way you feel, and no one else is guilty. And so, you know, you really do have to take responsibility. But then after you are able to do that and not be too angry with yourself for being so stupid, you recognize, oh, well, you know, duh, I've been doing it all along, and, you know, it's my choice always. And then you're free. It's a freedom that comes from just recognizing, you know, I'm responsible for the world I see. I choose the thing that I think.
And it's purposive. And that, I think that was one of the words that clicked purposive for me when Ken Wapnick talked about that. And when I first heard the way he described it, how Eastern mysticism gives us the essence of the dualistic, awareness of the dualistic nature of the world and how reality is beyond that. And it shows us that anything involving space, time, individuality, energy, matter, all the myriad forms has to be illusory. And modern physics corroborates that beautifully, or at least points in that direction if we're honest with our assessment of what it's saying. And that's where I think those, some of the luminaries of a few decades ago that basically were the forerunners of, and the originators of what we call quantum mechanics and modern physics. You know, they were all kind of like, what? How could mind be back in the equation here? You know, we thought we got rid of that with physics, you know, and here it was pointing solidly that, you know, mind is not an afterthought. The mental realm has to be not only, you know, vital, but primary in anything that we look at with physics. And that's why so Heisenberg or Bohr, I'll have to look at that quote, I put it in my book, my second book, so I can find it easily enough. It's basically something to the effect of, if quantum mechanics hasn't profoundly shocked you, you haven't understood it, you know, which is basically saying that,
exactly.
I think I probably paraphrased that too, of course, but that was the idea, is that if we really take the implications that there's just one thing and we have the apparent perception of different stuff in the universe, you know, different electrons, different molecules, different galaxies. That's just an appearance, but it's not the reality. And that's what physics was getting at. And that's certainly where metaphysics has been at for well, certainly in the esoteric traditions and for millennia. You know, you mentioned Nisargadatta and Ramana Maharshi and people like that have, you know, more contemporary, but you know it's got to go back many, many millennia. And of course, the miracle is just one part of that. But what to finish that thought, what Ken Wapnick was, I think, brilliantly suggesting is that for our Western culture, anyway, the profound contribution that A Course in Miracles makes, that it adds to that wonderful legacy of the Eastern thought about illusion, is that it's purposive, and that the unconscious sin, guilt, fear paradigm is at the heart of that insanity, and it has to be looked at in order to see the why. It's because we think, again, it gets down to this really simple idea that we think we threw God under the bus. We think we shattered perfect oneness at our hand, but we've turned around to the "Behold me, brother, at your hand I die." But that's all because we think we killed everyone else. We think we killed everyone else as us. We think we killed, this all-encompassing perfect innocence and love and peace by making up a world. And well, even before that, by making up a whole thought system in which that could have been possible, which, of course, it never was. But that's not our experience here. So anyway, I'll continue on with the answer here.
Before you go on, though, I did want to go to that word purposive, because I think it's something that you can recognize. In fact, it's something that I recognize, like, daily, many, 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 many times. is how is my own purposive desire to be upset, my own purposive desire to differences, my own purposive desire to be an exception, to say, oh, wait, no, wait, no, wait, I'm being a victim here. It's a purposive desire, the desire to be right and to be overwhelmingly right so that anybody else is wrong. This is the ego at its height. That's how it operates.
Yeah.
So never ever imagine that even, you know, you make me feel bad. No, I'm not a victim of you. I'm feeling bad because I choose to feel bad. Look at my own motives, my own purpose. And when I do that, it is almost unbearable to see. And yet once I look at it, I recognize, oh, you know, I've been doing it all along. And, you know, I hate to say this, everybody does it. Because that's just the way the ego works. The ego is that. It has nothing to do with any personal choice, it has nothing to do with anything other than that's just the way the ego operates. And so don't take it personally. Don't think I'm being bad. Just recognize, oh, I'm thinking with this ego thought system that is rationalizing all this stuff into making you look bad and me look good. And, you know, stop it. Just stop it.
The Bob Newhart therapy again.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just have to stop it. Yeah, exactly. So I'll stop the volley of mutually inspired ideas and actually read the first paragraph of the answer in this FAQ, which is 1251 from facimoutreach.org in their series of over 1300 wonderful frequently asked questions. And this one begins with no. You are not a, quote, puppet on someone's string, unquote. And A Course in Miracles' theory of time does not entail predestination. Okay. In fact, one of the major objectives of Jesus' teachings is to have us realize that our decision to choose ego or him as our teacher determines what our experience will be at every instant. But it would not be entirely accurate to say that we therefore create our reality. And before we go on, that ties into a concept that I think we're all learning to figure out, but a concept that's helped me is the idea that within the ego's dream script, the script is written in a sense that, and I think quantum mechanics bears that out, at least that in any one particular, quote, reality, unquote, of which there may be, you know, countless parallel realities, there is predestination. Or there is a, you know, a script, if you will. But that's where, if we try to jump from one dream to another, that's not going to work. If we try to use the ego's thought system in order to get free of the ego, intuitively, especially if you phrase it that way, right? Ain't going to happen. But if we, instead of choosing among illusions, choose the thought systems that's beyond illusions, which is forgiveness, which in a sense it is an illusion, but it takes us to a remembrance of that awareness that we took with us into the dream that transcends the illusion. It's only, you know, getting above the battleground as the battlefield as the Course puts it, that we then get to jump to a different time track or a different reality or a different script. And I think that's where when we, you know, we choose our real nature, the shared identity, the shared interest, the forgiveness track, if you will, we essentially kind of jump and can make those quantum leaps to a different reality. And that's what I think the holy instant is those moments where we catch ourselves, like you're saying so beautifully, Lynn, is that where the rubber meets the road and we see when we're not feeling at peace and in our everyday interactions with other people and whether we're in front of someone or not, whether we're thinking of someone, you know, if we're thinking of someone in a way that divides and makes differences a big deal, yeah, we're back on the battleground. We're back in that script. And, you know, it's foolproof from within that level, and we're not going to get out of it from that level. But we always have that inner kindness teacher that says, hey, there's another way of looking at the world that transcends the illusion, and we're using metaphorically a vertical axis shift that instead of trying to horizontally pick illusion A instead of illusion B or C, we just, you know, climb up above the labyrinth because there's no ceiling on it, and look out at the vast, you know, maze of false choices, if you will, and realize that none of that's going to make us happy. But choosing the teacher of kindness, where we're truly free, does make us happy at any given moment, and that's real freedom. That's where the peace and or the innocence that we all share is restored. When it's no longer my innocence at your expense, or vice versa, you know, neither of which works. So anyway, thoughts on that before we go to the next paragraph?
Sure. Yeah. just on this paragraph, when he's talking about the Course in Miracles theory of time does not entail predestination. Mm-hmm. So we've talked quite a bit recently about what does Jesus mean by the script is written. Because the script is written would almost surely say that, you know, whatever happens is predestined, is something that we decided on a long time ago, when we decided that we wanted to see what it was like to be special or separate from God, or, excuse me, I'm getting a cold here. Anyway, we decided a long time ago how the script was going to be and what was going to happen. So the idea that there's not predestination, you know, that kind of gives the question, well, then what does that mean if the script is written? Why does that not mean predestination? And what it means is all possibilities are still there of any type of action, activity, or behavior. All possibilities are there, were created at the very moment, or invented at the very moment that we wondered what it would be like, because these are all the things that could happen if you're separate from God. You know, you could, you know, elect Donald Trump president. You could, you know, get a cold. You could, you know, get up at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock on your part to, you know, talk to somebody about A Course in Miracles. All these things are part of the possibilities of events in the script, and all actually are already there. But it's our choice, not of whether to do it or not, but it's really our choice as to how to experience what it is that appears to be happening. Right. And Jesus also talks to us about, you know, going the happy dream, that there is another reality, that there are other, it sounds to me like, you know, other storylines in the script that, once you've, you know, learned the lesson, it's like going through school, you know, you learn the lessons from fifth grade and then you move on to sixth grade. You don't carry your fifth grade textbooks with you when you go to sixth grade and say, well, wait a minute, I need to go back to that. You just go on. And so I think that's what happens here, is that, you know, when we learn the lesson, we move to the next story or the next lesson, until we learn all the lessons and completely absolve the script of any responsibility and are therefore able to do as Jesus said, seeing that there are no order of difficulty in miracles, mm-hmm. and nothing, there's no differences between anything.
Right, right. And that ties into the idea that I think that doesn't, you know, contradict what you just said, because I think we have the experience of having different lessons, but I think it's very complimentary to suggest that, in a sense, what appear to be different lessons really are ultimately variations on the same lesson, which is that oneness has never been compromised, and that we as seeming individuals weren't able to pull that off, and so therefore that identity essentially didn't happen, and so we begin to the world becomes more and more surreal. And not just crazy in the way that we usually think of it, but in a very gentle, kind-hearted way, becomes very forgivable, because we see that our part in making that up had no effect on the reality that we all share, that lives unaffected beyond and behind that dream. And but it's the same lesson, no matter how many different ways it's presented to us. because it would be too fearful, I think, for us to get that whole teaching at once, we've made up a dream in which it seems like a gentler awakening to get parts of that curriculum at a time. But ultimately, I think we do get hints and reminders now and then that it is all the same lesson. That's why the no order difficulty of miracles is the very first miracle principle on page one of the text. You know, it's like, okay, there's no lesson that's harder or more difficult or more important than any other, because it's all the same lesson.
Yeah, and the thing that's beautiful about that first miracle principle, not only does it say that it's all the same lesson, it also says that all expressions of love are maximal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the answer to the difficulties, the answer to the ego's thought system completely, any expression of love, all expressions of love are able to overcome that.
Yes.
So, and that is really, really wonderful, because that just says to me personally that it doesn't matter how feeble my attempt is, it's maximal, because it's miraculous, and miracles are based on love. It's all about love.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's our reality. That's what's behind the facade.
Exactly.
And
we all
share that. Everyone shares that.
Everyone shares that. Whether you feel it or not, whether you know it or not, whether you're experiencing it that way or not, it is there. It actually is there. We haven't changed. We're not different. We haven't made ourselves into something aberrant in the universe. All we have done is turned and looked in a different direction. And so everything seems backwards to us. We're in a completely backwards world. And boy, when that hit me that, you know, everything here is backwards. You know, if I think, if I think it's right, then someone else thinks it's wrong. If I think it's good, then someone else is going to think it's bad. We're never going to agree in this illusion, because it's all made to be the anti-heaven, you know, the complete opposite of truth and reality. So let me go on and read the next paragraph. So we've already decided that it would not be entirely accurate to say that we therefore create our reality, because, you know, obviously that's only through our mind. If I choose the ego as my teacher, then my thoughts will emanate from the thought system of separation, and whatever is going on externally will be interpreted by me, this backwards world, my decision maker, accordingly. The ego thought system will be a kind of template in terms of which my internal experience of the external will be created. When I interact with you, for instance, my ego needs will determine how I experience you. I do not create your reality. I create my perception of you based on my prior choice to listen to the ego rather than Jesus or the Holy Spirit. And again, right there, if I listened to Jesus or the Holy Spirit, when I saw you, I would see the Christ.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw you, I would see the Holy Son of God. Well, obviously, I'm not listening to them, because when I see you, I see Bruce, the guy, you know, in California. Or not California, Oregon now. So obviously I'm creating something external that is not real. So let's see. I do not create your reality. I create my perception of you based on my prior choice. And that, again, where Jesus does say in the Course, everyone makes an ego for himself and for others. And what I see when I look at you is the self that I made for you, the ego that I made for you, and not the truth of what you are. So, you know, this is why we're in such a mess. Okay, I do not create your reality. I create my experience, my perception of you based on my prior choice to listen to the ego rather than Jesus or the Holy Spirit. And my perception of you may not even square with the objective reality because my ego needs could result in distorted perception. Yeah, which is frequently the case. It's almost always the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never perceive another person as being wholly good, wholly loving, wholly joyful, wholly harmless. You know, it doesn't matter who, even my own children, I'm afraid of them. You know, I mean, they're going to say something that's going to upset me. They're going to do something that's going to make me worry. I'm assigning guilt to everyone around me by my decision, by this decision right here. This distorted perception that takes care of my ego needs or placates my ego needs.
And the whole world agrees with us. If you just look at how much of the media is devoted to the reassignment of blame and guilt and you know, culpability. Oh, that whole thing is just, if you really look how much of our world is devoted to that. And even in more subtle ways, when we honor people who we think are you know, wonderful crusaders against something, it also oftentimes has the implication that everyone else is the bad guy or the.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of interesting to just watch anything that makes differences a big deal. How pervasive that whole thought system is. Of specialness that really brings about in only within a dream the reinforcement that you know the illusion has been accomplished.
Exactly.
That the dream is real.
And what's so crazy about this, Bruce, and you know, we're just finishing the text for the year, and we do follow the Circle of Atonement calendar for the text. So we just did the Savior's vision, and now we're done actually. So we're but in the Savior's vision, and there are many other places in the course where Jesus says to us, if you could just look at one brother and see him as wholly worthy of forgiveness, it would change the way you see everything. You would be able to see the way that Christ sees just by looking at one brother and absolving him of this character ego thought that you put in place of what he is, this distorted perception. So this perception thing is just so huge in changing our minds to restoring our minds to sanity that if you're not doing this, if you're not working on trying to perceive the innocence of your brother, the sinlessness of your brothers, and especially if you're spending most of your time, which many of us are, assigning blame and guilt to our brother instead of seeing him wholly worthy of forgiveness,
uh-huh,
then all we're doing is perpetuating the madness in the world. And, you know, you talk about coming into a world situation like right now looks really kind of scary if you follow politics in the news. If I'm looking at any of those characters and seeing them as being sinful and evil, you know, Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, you know, whoever, I'm perpetuating the madness. And not only am I perpetuating the madness, I think I'm doing it on a much deeper level because I know better. You know, I already know that that's not the way to go. And so for me,
the pain.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the pain of the really the mental anguish, if you will, of self-persecution that takes the.
Okay.
Four. Still there?
Yeah, it's like I kind of lost you there for a minute. Can you repeat that? The pain, you started with the pain and I didn't hear the rest of what you said. So can you repeat that again? Okay, I think it might be Skype. I might be losing Bruce. No. Can you still hear me, Bruce? No. All right, I lost Bruce. I got to get him back because I want to hear what he has to say. Oh, buddy. And this thing is all trying to save. Oh. Who's not on this call? It says I still got him. Here, try that. My Skype is going nuts. Oh, poop.
Okay.
Whoa.
Hello.
Yay! Got you back. can you hear me?
Glenn.
Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Okay. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Why don't we move on? Yeah.
All right, let's just move on. Yeah.
Okay.
So, why don't you go ahead and read the, did I just read the second paragraph and you read the third?
Yeah. Okay. It is next to impossible for us to jump from our experience of ourselves as physical, psychological individuals to an experience of ourselves as minds, not bound by time or space. Even the intellectual understanding of mind is not easy for us, as you have found. One of the reasons for this difficulty is that we are far more invested in the ego thought system than we realize. And since the core of the ego strategy is to keep us mindless, attempting to perceive a realm beyond the body and specifics, the realm of mindlessness, would seem quite unnatural and frustrating to us, and almost impossible to attain. We would be fighting against ourselves to perceive everything as mind when, at the same time, we are upholding a decision to deny our identity as mind. So there, I mean, that's describes our challenge to a T, doesn't it? Because we're all trying to get back to an awareness that we're mind while we're so ambivalent and we have, you know, divided loyalty to the two thought systems moment to moment. And sometimes the loyalty to egos, me first at the expense of anyone else or everyone else, takes hold. And in that decision in our mind that we all have a choice in, and that's where the freedom lies. Is fortunately, it's not out there somewhere. It's not we're not appendage to anyone else, and we're not the puppet on someone else's string, as this question asks, because we all have that choice moment to moment as to which of those two thought systems we want to identify with, which loyalty we want to have with those two ways of thinking, huh?
Yes, and it has to be constant. You know, I think this is the thing that I was thinking about last night, because I was, you know, you go through these things where you're just saying, my God, you know, I have so much work to do. And, you know, here, you know, I mean, give me, you know, 10 or 15, even 20 years ago, you know, people would tell me, oh, I think you're, you know, you're close to being enlightened. You're so, you know, you know so much or whatever. But, you know, I see now every single moment of my particular failure to forgive, to perceive the Christ, to, you know, I think I was happier before I knew all this, even though I was miserable, because I had something to blame on it. And I was, you know, I was a victim and I could wallow in that. Now that I see that I'm responsible for everything, it's like, well, Jesus, I can't just, you know, I can't go back. And I can't undo.
Can I make a rebuttal to that?
Sure.
Because I've had those thoughts too at times. But what I'm consoled by, if that's the right word, is the recognition that if we're really honest with, and I think Ken Wapnick in some of his commentaries has suggested that if you really go back and honestly look, and the Course does too, at your past, you would recognize that it wasn't the cakewalk and it wasn't the beatific, joyous experience. Even if we think we had a happy childhood, which, you know, some of us may have had moments of that. If you really kind of look back and honestly kind of do a little deep mind searching, you recognize that there was always a discontent or a discomfort throughout all those experiences. There was always something more that was lacking. And I think that's why we've been drawn to, I probably am, you know, being presumptuous to speak for everyone listening to this, but I think if we're honest with ourselves, if we're drawn to this study of our mind, which is that the whole focus of the curriculum of A Course in Miracles, we have to be willing to recognize that we haven't been happy, and otherwise we wouldn't need this curriculum. We wouldn't need the course to help us get back to our mind to see where we've chosen against our peace, where we've chosen against the innocence that includes everyone. And
exactly. Well, and you know, and during that time when I was speaking of, I was probably mostly suicidal too. So, you know, but I had,
well, there you go.
But I had this like deep, you know, feeling, it was like I was ecstatic so much of the time, you know, feeling like really close to God and really connected. And then, you know, I would go from that into just like deep despair. So it was, you know, quite a bit of back and forth at the time. Right now, I can't even imagine even the thought of, you know, why would I even care to kill myself? You know, nothing's going on. It's, you know, I'm very content, actually. And I think content is a really good word. I'm very content. I'm not unhappy. I'm not in despair. You know, anything that happens, I can see, oh, wow, I just need to shift my thinking about this. And I do, you know, shift much more easily and quickly now because, you know, I've already seen that the truth of nothing real can be threatened and nothing unreal exists. So, yeah, that, you know, definitely much different the way that I feel now than I felt then. But I do recall being like having such wildly high and, you know, wildly low experiences that were so dramatic that they were attractive to me. It was very attractive to me. Either way, I felt my ego was feeling like empowered.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's
now
the, there's the clue right it. There. You just said it. Yeah. And that's I would call that a euphoric experience because I think as people get into, you know, their spiritual path, whatever you want to call that, there have been times, you know, very frequently that we probably all could, you know, attest to that there have been moments of that we've been unfettered by the prior constraints. I think if I look at some of those experiences honestly, I realize that a lot of them I appendage to being at a particular place, like backpacking trips in the Sierras and seeing something, you know, a beautiful lake or a sunset or something. Yeah, but or being with certain people and having a particular experience and thinking, well, now, gee, I couldn't go back to that because those people are, you know, some of them are no longer around at all, you know, or you know, getting them together in the same context and circumstance would be literally impossible.
And even if you did, it wouldn't be the same.
Exactly. And I think we try to do that. But there's an audio commentary about Lesson 182 that Ken does on, and it talks about, you know, if we were to go back to our childhood memories, you know, we would recognize that they weren't really all that great. You know, otherwise, why would we feel the need to search for something more? Why would we have been striving all this time to have a spiritual understanding that goes beyond the roller coaster ride of you know, euphoric highs to dark nights of the soul and everything in between? I think it's not just the stability, but we want the stability of the permanence of a peace that couldn't possibly be shaken by anything involving circumstances or space and time or conditions, huh?
Yes, exactly. And being, when you get into that situation where you are in that state of just calm, not ecstatic, not miserable, just, it's a very centered kind of place to be. There are times, you know, then you think, well, you know, what about when I used to feel ecstatic? I want to feel that way again. Or, but there, you know, when you look at the purpose, the reason that I felt that way was because everything else around me was falling to shit. You know, that changes then the motivation. And you know, recognize that, you know, in this place where I am content, yes, I don't feel any really huge highs and lows of anything, but everything is just sweet, and I'm very happy in this place. So, you know, the ego will still tell you you need to bump it up there, get out and, you know, get some excitement going on, you know, find something to worry about, you know, that'll give you plenty of ammunition to then feel better later. you're punching yourself and someone says, why are you punching yourself? Oh, because it feels so good when I stop.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's it. So, okay. So, let's see, we're on paragraph 4. Therefore, what might help ease the pressure and confusion you are experiencing is to approach this issue from a different direction, shifting your focus to the purpose or the way you are using the world, your body, and your relationships, rather than trying so hard to relate to the world and everyone as thought. Okay, so he's talking about going into what is my purpose?
The why, exactly.
Yeah, what is my purpose?
Mm-hmm.
Not just okay. So it is true that there is only mind and thoughts in the mind, but your experience of that will come more naturally if you focus first on becoming comfortable with recognizing the purpose in your mind that is motivating the way you relate and interact in the world. You know, let's get to the source of this thinking. Mm-hmm. The practice of this would lead you eventually to see beyond the appearances of individuality to the decision-making mind that is, quote-unquote, in charge. Then you would see that no one is under anyone else's control, unless that kind of experience is wanted. But then that choice could be changed at any instant.
And that experience of having that happen, in quotes, is just that. It's basically an illusion of a situation that we've chosen at a level that we're not consciously recognizing, having made that choice. So,
right, and become conscious of that,
mm-hmm,
shifts everything. Once you realize, I did this, I'm doing it.
But we don't. I think what this paragraph and the FAQ in general is suggesting is that to get to an awareness of mind directly is very challenging. But if we can look at our relationships and see the purpose of ego's propaganda and the Holy Spirit's undoing of that propaganda as an opportunity with every interaction we have with anyone else, whether it's, you know, a virtual one in our mind or a physical one where the quote unquote other person is in front of us or we're talking on the phone or whatever. It doesn't really matter because our perception is, the result of projecting out, purposefully, a separate self so that we have a sparring partner, that we have a battle because we want the battle. And until we see that the ego's goal is always to maintain the battle, we're going to continue to be out there on the battlefield. And we have to look down and see, oh, well, I've picked up the sword again.
Right.
You know, whenever we see the sword in our hand, metaphorically, it's like, oh, well, I must have chosen to see things wrongly. I wanted it was purposive for me to want to be upset with a physical condition in my body or a state of the government that in the country that I live in an environmental issue or crisis that appears to be happening on the planet that I think I'm living on. You know, all those things are purposive anything in between.
And what is the purpose?
Yeah.
The purpose is always, and this is my own opinion, and I just see it in my own self, to assign guilt.
Yeah.
Either I'm guilty or you're guilty. Mm-hmm. The purpose is always to bring about guilt, and then guilt is what causes me to continue to, you know, revel in the upset. So the guilt, you remind me what you're saying of the chapter 5, Decision for God, where, you know, Jesus says, you know, I can choose differently. I recognize I'm feeling this because I chose this. I recognize that, you know, it isn't helping me. I choose to decide differently, and I do not feel guilty about this choice, because the Holy Spirit will undo all of anything that might have happened because of that particular thing that I thought I did. So this is the, you know, when we get to the place where, you know, we recognize, oh, I'm just trying to make you feel guilty, or if I do this to you, I'm going to feel guilty. If I assign you this blame, I'm going to feel guilty. If I cut you off, I'm going to feel bad. Well, I don't have to, because all I have to do is choose again. And all of that, anything that would have made me feel guilty, is undone completely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it was never done in the first place. But
exactly. And it never happened. It never happened. And we only see that when we don't make the other person guilty. As you were talking, Lynn, I kind of flashed on some of my early school background. Remember truth tables? I think you have sort of an engineering background, right? I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I happened to Google truth table, and I see this little table that shows true, 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 false, false, true, and false, false. And the only one that really works is true, true. So I think that's what a great symbolism for the peace that we're looking for. It only works when everyone is true is in their truth and in our mind, when we see everyone is truly innocent, and that's when it becomes really simple. But as long as there's a true and a false, or a one and a zero, whether I'm the one and you're the zero, or vice versa, or if we're both zeros, then that isn't workable. That doesn't bring the peace. And the zero really is the ego thought system, and the oneness is the Holy Spirit's identity that is all inclusive, the capital I inclusive, that doesn't leave anyone out. And that's the oneness that we're all looking for. So I'll post this little graphic. Yeah,
it's simple, very simple.
Yeah, this is a truth. It's a truth table with one condition, and that condition is the only condition that exists in truth. But everything else is illusory, and that, because we probably weren't given that in our grade school, high school, or college classes. But what a great metaphor. It's so simple. You just basically remove all the other entries in that table, and then it's just true all the way across, and then that's where the peace is.
You know, that's so funny, Bruce, because I was just, I was talking about watching this Nisargadatta thing. That's exactly what he is saying. He's saying all you have to do is just look, and anything that's not true, just reject it. Just recognize and look at yourself.
Right.
Look, and that's what he's talking about when he says, I am that. He's not saying look and say I am something. He says, look at what you think you are. You know, you think you're a woman, you think you're a human, you think you have a brain, you think you're this, you think you're, you know, an American. You know, those are kind of gross things, but other things like, you know, I think I'm cold, I think I'm hungry, I think I'm not any of those things. The truth is, I'm not any of those things.
Right.
And when I can see myself beyond the attributes, says, "What I am has no attribute." You can't describe it.
Right, right. Yeah. But so, but I think we get, if we try to go directly to that, as this FAQ reminds us, it's going to be an uphill battle.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
But if we can get at it from a sort of a, you know, an indirect way, I think that's how the course would suggest it, we go at it, is to look at our specific relationships and look at the specific instances of ego's propaganda that come up as a reflection of that choice for the ego, then we can tackle those. We can look at and catch ourselves right in mid-thought and say, oh, I was about to make this person the bad guy. I was about to make this political party or this country or this gender or this corporation or whatever the scapegoat in my mind's goatscape. but that's a fake image. That's basically a false perception that has arisen from the propaganda of an insane thought system that I can stop choosing to identify with at any moment. Yeah,
exactly. And it is. It's not something you can do just, you know, right off the bat. It's something that, because you'll never be hurled into reality without. I mean, you really do have to gradually look at and let go of what's unreal. And you know, if otherwise you're just going to try to hang on to what is familiar, and so you know, we need to just stop identifying with that and stop identifying others with it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, that's the main thing, is what you know, it's one thing about what I think I am, but it's something entirely different about what I think you are. And because what I think you are is a projection of my own thinking. And so it makes it so easy to look at what I'm projecting onto you to see what I think I am. And boy, that's not fun. That's very, that's painful. But it's true. You know, if I didn't see myself as being, you know, take, for instance, you know, I'm not trying to get political, but, you know, a person that we all know and recognize, Donald Trump, our new president, is there anything in his behavior that you object to that is not something that you do yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not asking for confessions. I'm just saying, look at yourself.
Right, right.
If you think is he's doing it and it's bad, how are you doing it yourself? And, you know, that's painful.
Sure it is. Sure it is. Yeah.
But it's helpful, too, to do that.
Maybe we can have a special edition in 3 weeks of using that particular example as how we project our own unconscious guilt onto political figures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm telling you what. Once you start looking at it, it's, yeah.
and it's what a great opportunity we have to look at our unconscious stuff through the lens of those specifics, and it may seem like that this is different, but it's all the same. It's years ago on Merv Griffin's show, if you remember that, Mahesh Yogi, who's the founder of Transcendental Meditation, I can say that, was asked about, you know, what he think, and this was like what, 70s, 80s, something like that. He was asked about, you know, what he thought of the current political system, and everyone was aghast at how awful things were then, and you know, how gone awry things were in Washington D.C. and after the audience the commentator went on, you know, to reinforce that, they finally said, well, let's ask our guest here what he thinks. And he says, well, of course, you know, it's your, you know, again, paraphrasing, it's your thought system that has brought this into your awareness. And, you know, basically suggesting that it was a gift for them to be able to look at that, part of their minds. You know, not in so many words, but that was the essence of what I got from it. And of course the audience was dumbfounded and just like, you know, went silent, like, oh, well, okay, next subject kind of thing. We don't want to look at our minds. Come on now. let's move along. Not the droids we're looking for, kind of.
That's pretty funny. Well, yeah, because my gosh, you know, how could you think that? I mean, back in those days, that was not even a whisper in anybody's mind.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I mean that you know, it's not a whisper in many people's minds now. If you tell people, you know, what you're seeing here is a reflection of your own thought system. They're like, you are insane, and you know, you don't know
moi.
You know, that's what I get a lot. You don't know me. No, I don't know you, but I definitely know ego, and you know, I don't think ego is different in different people. It's
right. Basically
it's doing the same thing all the way around. And so
we just get this wonderful caricature to see what's in the content of our own mind. And if we can remember to extrapolate that and generalize and apply that to everyone that we meet, then we have opportunities for holy instance restored to us. So should I read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Okay. For example, as long as we identify with the ego's thought system of separation, it is a given that we will relate to each other in the context of specialness, which means we will judge some people, ties right in, doesn't it, as not deserving our love, compassion, and forgiveness, even ourselves at times. Specialness and exclusion go hand in hand. We can thus learn to recognize how we use people to keep ourselves in the particular state of specialness we desire to get what we want. And looking at ego's propaganda reveals that whole swamp that we have drained back into our own mind for examination. And that actually can be a very helpful thing to notice when when we bring our own projections back inside our mind. We can say, because it's no longer out there. It's no longer somebody else doing something to me. It is myself projecting, making this perception, that then I can reel back in, take responsibility for, but then it's not only no longer unconscious, it becomes unfounded, because that brings it back to the, if we bring it to the awareness with our inner kindness teacher, with Holy Spirit, then we see the fallacy of the whole argument, and it just dissolves. It literally goes away, and then it's replaced with the piece that we thought we lost. So that's our three forgiveness, the three R's of forgiveness again. It's the reveal, the fact that it's not outside. We release our investment in the thought system that made that projection. And then the replacement is automatic. We don't have to do any part of that. It's just
no, right.
The reality is just there. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where the Holy Spirit undoes all the effects of my wrong thinking. If I let them.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's what happens. So,
yeah.
Perfect.
How do I read that middle part of that paragraph again? Yeah. Specialness and exclusion go hand in hand. We can thus learn to recognize how we use people to keep us in the state of mind, in the mind's compulsion to see and judge differences. That whole revelation, huh? And so we can learn to recognize that demand. When we feel the least bit upset with someone that comes on our TV screen or someone that walks into the room that in the place we live or someone who we try this propaganda has.
Bruce, you're cutting out on us here a little bit. I'm not sure what's happening. But I'm hoping you can hear me, and I don't know what, it's like maybe as the signal's going in and out or something. Maybe you're having weather.
Well, you know. I use these a lot, so can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah.
Well.
Okay. So I didn't hear, but I got the gist of what you were saying about the roots of specialness.
How about? Okay, still there?
Yeah, still here.
Okay, good.
All right.
Okay. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
I'll go to the next paragraph. Okay. As we continue this process of looking and observing, we will be shifting our attention more and more away from form to the content in our minds. And eventually we will relate to ourselves and everyone else primarily on that level. while at the same time we'll be functioning normally in our day-to-day activities and form. Thus, when we realize how we make differences important and then seek to correct that, we change teachers in our mind, our perception will shift to the interests we all share, that we are all suffering tremendous anguish and guilt over believing we selfishly separated from our source, and that we are all longing to go back home to heaven. As that becomes our abiding perception, then our investment in individuality will begin to weaken without our even working on that directly. You know, it's not that, you know, I got to stop trying to see you as an individual or stop trying to see myself as an individual. It really is that I decide to see that you and I are the same, and that our needs are the same and our motives are the same, even though it may seem like they're different, and you know, it may seem like we're completely different from each other. When I can see that you want what I want, which is peace, and really we all want the same thing, and everyone has an idea of how to attain that, and so it's, you know, my idea is to control you, and therefore I'll be at peace. And if that's the case, then I'll never be at peace unless I'm in control of you. And when I'm in control of you, I'll definitely not be in peace, because then I'll have to maintain control. So it's just bringing me into more and more and more upset. So you know, just recognize that, you know, what you want, even, you know, Donald Trump, that's all he wants. He doesn't want anything that you and I don't want. Mm-hmm. We all want the same thing. But how we go about it or how we get it, you know, that's a different thing altogether. But, you know, I can't condemn your means, because I know that you want what I want. And so the only thing that I can do is control my own thinking. And when I see you as the Christ, then all of these other things that you appear to be doing, I recognize are just innocent mistakes on your part. And, you know, an innocent mistake can't hurt anyone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, and there's the tremendous gentleness that comes from that awareness. Because we see that everyone at any given moment, including ourselves, is either expressing love or calling out for it. And that's really freeing, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And it's always, you know, everyone's calling for love. And so, you know, what is my job? You know, what are we here for? You know, I'm here to be an expression of my Father's love. You know, I'm here to, you know, accept the atonement, accept my mind being corrected so that I see the truth of what you are. And if that's the case, if all I'm doing is trying to see the love that you are, the truth that you are, and looking only for that, then I'm not going to see your silly mistakes. And if I see them, I'm going to laugh, because I know it's a silly mistake, but I'm not going to condemn you because of it. That's really, you know, to me, that's, you know, I think that's Jesus. Jesus, you know, I just see he must have been just so filled with compassion for all of those people that did everything that they appeared to do to him, because he could see the fear and guilt that they were in. You know, I could just see that, you know, that to even look in his eyes, you know, the story of, I think it's Saint Germain, who was, the soldier was, you know, putting the nails into Jesus's hands and looked into Jesus's eyes, and, you know, what, I don't know what happened, but how could you help it if you're with a being that is just exuding nothing but love, and you look into that being's eyes? What, you know, what are you going to see? You know, you're only going to see the love of yourself. Mm-hmm. And that would definitely change a person, I would think. Yes. It's changed me when I've been with people that I thought were like Amma, you know, just nothing but love. Hey, you can't condemn that.
Yeah, whenever we don't go along with the ego's propaganda. We provide an opportunity to see the shared interests and go beyond the feelings of the anguish and the horrific quality. And I think that's where it really, you know, it behooves us to look at the contents of our mind honestly, moment to moment, and see when we're feeling anything less than perfect peace. And that's going to be, again, with honesty, pretty much most of the time. And if we can see that and become more and more attuned to that and recognize that throughout the history of our lives in this particular body, on this particular planet, that's been the case, you know, we will no longer wax nostalgic over an ideal childhood and wish to return to that. We'll recognize that really the true peace that can't possibly change is really our destiny, and we can work toward making that completely consistent by noticing how we feel, seeing everyone's expressions, including our own, as either a call for love or an expression of it, and then use that to get back to the mind, reeling in our thoughts, seeing that it's not anything anyone else is doing, because there's no one else in truth, and that gets us in the forgiveness classroom again. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. And I think this is the last paragraph.
I think there might be. Did we already?
I just read.
As we continue?
That one.
Okay.
So, although I can read it again because it really, and then I'll just go on to the next paragraph. As we continue this process of looking and observing, we'll be shifting our attention more and more away from form to the content in our minds. And eventually we will relate to ourselves and everyone else primarily on that level, while at the same time we will be functioning normally in our day-to-day activities in form. And that when I was reading that, I was thinking about how many times does Jesus tell us in the Course, I'll substitute for your ego for you. Mm-hmm. I will, you just be with me and I will do the day-to-day activities for you. You don't have to worry about it. It will be done.
And the ego is the substitute. That's the irony, isn't it?
It is, exactly. The ego is the substitute. And when we stop thinking with the ego and start thinking with the Christ mind, everything is perfect. Oh, and Jack is asking where we're reading. Let me give you a link to the we're in the FACIM outreach, question number 1251. So we're letting Jesus substitute for our ego and turn back to our right minds, recognizing that we all are suffering tremendous anguish and guilt over believing we selfishly separated from our source. See, and that's it. It's just this anguish and guilt that we think we're experiencing from this feeling of separation. And as we start joining with the Holy Spirit, and it says as that becomes our abiding perception, then our investment in individuality will begin to weaken without our even working on that directly. And that's what I find for myself. It really is interesting to me how much I don't want or care about things anymore. It's just, you know, I'm just happy with the way things are. So the transition to the experience of everything as mind, thus, would be more natural and certainly more gentle than trying to pressure ourselves to get beyond the body and form entirely, which is a lot of people are like, why, you know, let me get, you know, meditate so I get beyond the body and form. Let me get beyond, the, you know, and actually, if we just allow our minds to be shifted, it is simpler and much gentler, mm-hmm. and there's no guilt involved. This is why Jesus reminds us often that we are involved in a process of undoing what we have made in error. We start where we are, with what we are most familiar with. Near the end of the text, Jesus tells us, salvation does not ask that you behold the spirit and perceive the body not. It merely asks that this should be your choice. It doesn't mean you have to do it. It just means that you have to choose that. Thus, our willingness to change from the ego's purpose to the Holy Spirit's purpose for the world and the body is what will facilitate the gentle transition to true perception and to the vision we share with Jesus. And that opens us up to the happy dream.
Yeah.
That's really what happens.
And we become happy dreamers. And that it's that dreamer that recognizes that it's a dream that then is free. Because the dream isn't where the freedom is. It's in the dreamer's mind. And it's having chosen that different teacher with a different purpose. So anyway.
Yeah, well, and it can be done, and it's done every day. But it has to be done purposely. You have to really honestly want to change your mind.
And recognizing the feelings that arise moment to moment when there's the least little bit of discomfort, that's our cue. It's like, okay, I'm back into my curriculum of choosing which thought system, which teacher. And our inner kindness teacher will always has the purpose of returning wholeness to the mind, which means restoring the seemingly fragmented identities that appear to be in the form of different people and circumstances back to oneness by starting with the sameness, by realizing we're all in the same boat. We all are fighting the same difficult battles, as one of the Greek philosophers is quoted as having said. And that same battle is really a non-existent battle, but we think we're here, so we need to approach it from where we think we are on the battleground of physicality. And it doesn't, like it says here, it doesn't ask that we, you know, say I'm not a body and on the level of form, but it's saying on the level of mind, that's where we can really make a difference and see that our identity can transition from one of identifying with the dream figure to identifying with the mind that recognizes the dream figure as a dream. And that's where the freedom is.
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's freedom. And we have that. It is our birthright.
It is. Well, Happy New Year, everyone. And you can always reach me via ACIM blog, and I also have a Facebook page with that. And I know you've got lots of Facebook and online goodies as well, Lynn.
Oh, yeah. And also, this next year is going to be really cool because I'm going to be working on doing some workshops and retreats. And so I'm looking forward to 2017
Great.
As being a joyful year and not fearful at all. So anyway, thank you, Bruce. And I will send you this recording. And Bruce does post these on acimblog.com. And a lot of other good stuff. Bruce does a lot of other good work too. So, lots of discussions with Susan Dugan and Lynn Corona, all kind of good folks. All right. So, and I'm being told to play a song. So I'm going to put a song on, while Devin and Barb get ready. Anyway, thank you so much, Bruce, and Happy New Year to you too.
Happy New Year and have a great week all.
All right. Bye bye, hon.
Bye for now.
See you next week.